If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
A 4-0 defeat, one of your best players limping off with a hamstring injury. That's right, it's the magic of the FA Cup. Norwich City's 349-day unbeaten run in the competition ends and they go crashing out at the third round stage for what I think is the third time in about four, five seasons. It's not a great record. Welcome to this week's edition of the Pinken.com Norwich City podcast, brought to you in association with First Bus. I'm your host, Connor Southwell, and despite it being the Cup, we've not rotated too heavily. Paddy Davitt is to my right, Adam Harvey is to my left. If you're watching us visually, a little bit of a different setup. I wish I could say that our studio was having a great big refurb, but that's not the case. There's a little bit of work going on in that part of the building, so we've had to relocate. We've still got all of our set behind us, which is great, and it's still the same old faces, so hopefully it'll be okay. Paddy, if last week was encapsulated the madness, the brilliance of why we all love the brilliant sport of football, today was probably on the more depressing end of the spectrum.
Well, on the positive, we don't have to pay to get in, so that and we get paid to be there. But other than that, all joking aside, because it wasn't really a day for joking, it was a day for
wallowing.
Yeah, freezing in the cold. And yeah, as you said in the intro, Connor, sadly, we're literally 2-3 hours after the final whistle, so this will become clear, but it feels like there might be an injury subtext and quite a serious one, in the sense of Marcelinho Nunes unavailable for however long, but doesn't look good at this stage. Scans on Sunday, Johannes confirmed it was a hamstring injury. If there's a silver lining, in the sense that it isn't the hamstring or the leg, which he had the previous issues with earlier this season. But, you know, with no Slimani out for the foreseeable, you know, no Forsyth, no Sorensen, no Gibbs, just in terms of headcount, you know, they're now down to quite low levels of availability, potentially, if, and let's be honest, you know, when have they had a scan that hasn't come back in a positive fashion this season? It always feels that it is confirming the worst, and the gloom around that injury today, you know, the striking image for me, I looked up at the screens above us in the press box here at Carr Road, and Kenny McLean was crouched over Nunes while the physios were sort of just coming on and just trying to assess, and his face was like, this is not going to be end well. And if it is the case and there's no Nunes, then you can park your four goals against Brighton and a gulf really by the end, in terms of that's the Premier League. That's how far away Norwich are, this group anyway, from getting to those levels. All that is for the future, in the here and now. The major payoff from today isn't the end of the FA Cup road. It is potentially Marcelinho Nunes, a key figure in this Norwich rebuild, out for a length of time. And, you know, what was he out for? You know, previously it was a serious block of games. So if it's that again, you know, as I put to Johannes, does that force their hand now, between now and what remains of the transfer window, in terms of doing something in that area of the squad? And he had to countenance that, yes, they may, because of those bodies that they're missing currently, look at doing something. But he did put a very sobering caveat on it, that they don't have resources to go out and do anything major. It would have to be, you sense, quite a creative piece of business, because they haven't felt, at this stage, they were looking at something midfield-wise. I know we've had the debate on various platforms in recent days where Johannes had flagged the potential for a CDM, a six, but I think there's been a bit of rowing back in terms of, for this window, I don't think that was an objective. That wasn't where the recruitment focus lay in this window. But priorities change, and events dictate. And if, with an asterisk around that word at the minute, it is a layoff for Nunes, then I think they will have to try and do something in what remains of this window, and that is a pretty as bad as 4-0 feels in terms of on the pitch. That's a pretty horrid payoff for the far more, in my opinion, pressing matter of trying to maintain this festive momentum and built 10 points from 12 going into the onerous task of going to Sheffield United and then Leeds in short order and trying to maintain that sense of league momentum that they were beginning to harness. You know, that's going to be very difficult if you're without arguably your best midfielder in terms of the Torrop template for a period of time. So, yeah, pretty boring. But we nearly didn't get into the office as well. But that's another story. So because of the ongoing building work, which has forced this move up to from the ground floor where we've been recording to the editorial floor. So all in all, it's been a pretty bad day at the office. Yeah, literally for the Norwich office anyway. So yeah, but we'll try and find some shafts of light in amongst the gloom in this next hour. If not, then it'll just be a. Probably want to fast forward or not even listen to or watch, but please don't do that because obviously then we're wasting our time sat here for the next hour chatting about all things Norwich.
Yeah, we're not going to do too much on the game, so hopefully that's enough to convince you to stay. And as Paddy mentions, hopefully the light shafts that he mentioned aren't the ones of blue lights, because anyone watching CCTV will have seen us three move a fence to essentially not break into the building, because we had a pass to get through a door, but we had to move a bit of fence to get in that. So yeah, hopefully that doesn't result in any trouble for the next hour or so. We can deal with anything else afterwards. I guess the easy one, Adam, is when we're talking about Nunez, which, as Paddy said, feels a lot more... a much bigger blow for Norwich today than probably the 4-0 defeat did and the FA Cup run, if you want to call it that, because they're never going to win this competition. It's easy to say, isn't it? And it's almost an old cliche of, do you play your best players in these games because you risk injuries? Of course, you risk injuries in every game, but I guess with all the options that Paddy listed, no Slimani, no Sorensen, no Gibbs, Forsyth not quite ready, he probably had to be risked, didn't he, in terms of the options?
Yeah, his hands were pretty tired. I mean, the only other option is Marc Ondes, who wasn't even in the matchday squad, which you can assume that's resting him, because anyone who knows this situation, and I think it's pretty evident now, when he didn't have a club before he came to Norwich. He's obviously then played a large block of games in a relatively quick space of time. They did get that little rest in for him. Which game was it? QPR, I think, off the top of my head. But it's been pretty evident that he's been sort of just struggling, I think, with the amount of games he's had to be put through in recent times due to the lack of options they have. You know, it's pretty evident looking down that list, and you mentioned quite a few of them there. And, you know, even sort of going down to the 21s, could they have maybe dropped someone in? But then that's obviously a huge, huge risk today against Premier League opposition, and you don't really want to be sort of chucking them in at the deep end, even more so than in a Championship encounter against any opposition. So it was a difficult one, and the lack of options, even Svartal, you could make a case to put him into the midfield, but then, you know, that then... They don't have that many options that wide, so.
And he's 18 as well. Yeah. Like, I think that gets forgotten. He's been senior and he's obviously been part of the first team, but he's still 18, and I don't think he turns 19 before the end of the season. So that's still a very young man you're dropping into that position.
Yeah, and he's sort of been moulded now, sort of that wider position, and he's sort of starting to get used to that. So you don't really want to sort of row back on that and start trying to put him back into that central midfield sort of dynamic. So it's a difficult one. Normally his whole squad today was very much having to pick and choose who was available, because they're sort of so short in so many positions. I'm pretty certain would he have wanted to have started seeing that today? Probably not. But then when Sargent's only coming back from his own injury, again, limited options in the building at the moment, particularly given that, you know, Barnes has departed now as well. So yeah, all in all, it was tough for him. I would have personally preferred more rotation, but then who do you put in? So unfortunately, that, you know, Norwich have took the cost of that today, because there's obviously the Nunez one, which is the big one, but we're still await a little bit of news on Forsen and Callum Doyle as well.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is as well, is you put younger players in there, then suddenly you're talking about a 7-0 defeat. You're not talking about four potentially. So you have to retain an element of competition, which they had in the first 25 minutes. And then, obviously you take risks within that. Obviously, it was only a few weeks ago that he was having to manage Nunez's minutes, wasn't it? And what was the game? He pulled him off early and there was a little bit of a deterioration. One over the festive period, Millwall, they all merged into one, to be honest. So yeah, that's the risk you take. But, you know, as you mentioned, Paddy, when it's the opposite hamstring to the one that he did previously, it's probably not a lot you can do in terms of preserving him and his minutes, because it's not like we're talking about the same issue reoccurring as was the case with perhaps Liam Gibbs when he'd just come back and it was literally 10, 15 minutes into his return. This is obviously one that he's been managing. And also with muscle injuries as well, if you give players long breaks between games, that can be as harmful as resting them sometimes. So I think probably we're just going to have to file this as one of those things, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean I'm sure. I think Giannis has talked about this in a more general sense about the types of injuries. There was a little bit of a narrative around, you know, muscular sort of issues, and was that something that Norwich, as a club, as a, you know, medical department, as sports science teams, had to look at? You know, the load that the coaches were putting on these players, Colney week to Colney week, when you overlay how busy the fixtures schedule are, particularly when you condense it down to the festive period, which have just come through this squad. So, and obviously Nunes has played a lot of minutes in that festive period. So, yeah, I guess, you know, the way that we know Giannis works, I think no stone will be left unturned. And that might be something for more of an end of season review, that where they can, you know, out of the pressure cooker of a, you know, trying to win games of championship football primarily, they can really forensically look at their processes, you know, what they're doing with the players, how they're, as I say, training them, how they're rehabbing them when they've got injuries. Are there things that they can improve? Are there things they need to improve? If it's a reoccurrence of similar types of injuries, the whole process, I'm sure, will be looked at the right time. But in the here and now, you know, that's all well and good, but in the here and now, it's another hamstring-related injury to a player who has been susceptible to hamstrings. So, albeit maybe not the same leg, but you know, it is. I guess if you're honest tonight, you probably, like you said with McLean, I think earlier in the season, but that was more the suspension element, how he kicked himself that he played him in a certain game or didn't get him off before he picked up a yellow card, and that had a knock-on effect down the line. You know, he'll probably go home tonight and think, well, did I have to play Nunes? But I don't think you can retrospectively look at it like, because, I mean, it might have been another player today, you know, and might have been a younger player, might have been a player who hasn't had a lot of game time who came in, and because they were a little bit undercooked, maybe had an injury issue. So I don't think hindsight is really going to help us in this scenario. I could see why he went Nunes and McLean, because those two, one injury related, in McLean's case, suspension, hadn't had the blocks of minutes that maybe Marcondes had had to play or some of the other players. So I could understand why he went with them today. And obviously then there was the factor that you're playing a Premier League team, and he said it after the game as well, Giannis, he wanted to almost benchmark the rate of progress from maybe the Palace League Cup game earlier in the season against other Premier League opponents and how far they'd evolved as a group. Well, to do that, you'd really need to put some of your stronger players in to try and do that. So, you know, unfortunately it's ended badly, but I certainly wouldn't look to sort of look at, you know, could that have been avoided? Of course it could have been avoided. You could have switched out 11 players from Coventry, but then, as you said earlier, Connor, you know, they lost four. You know, what would have ended up on if it had been a really young team? You know,
and that's not good for the young guys is it? In terms of their development, yeah. And it can break people.
Yeah, and I'm sure. I mean, he said himself after the game, he didn't expect or want a 4-0 scoreline, but, you know, even if they'd have gone narrowly down, I think you'd still then retaining a lot of that sort of momentum maybe that you've built up over the Christmas period. And I'm not saying that's necessarily now been squandered, but, you know, all of those factors would have been in play with his selection process today. I mean, he spoke to you about how, you know, he wanted to respect this competition, how much he realised it meant. And Farke was the same. You know, he always took this competition very seriously, and that was always reflected in his team news. So, you know, anybody out there tonight maybe thinking, well, why did he risk players like Nunes? But, you know, what is the alternative? So, so it's just an unfortunate one, and, you know, kind of follows the theme, really. It just feels that they've not had a huge amount of luck in the area of keeping players fit or key players fit. We won't open a suspension can of worms because, you know, you might...
We'll do that later.
We might have to, yeah, but... But certainly injury-wise, yes. And they admitted when they talked about this at pre-Christmas, maybe there were one or two injuries that, okay, yeah, they can look at their processes and maybe they contributed or accentuated a susceptibility for players to pick up injuries. But I think in the main, I mean, that's come about today. He's gone to try and recover a ball on the edge of his own area. I can't remember who the Brighton player was, but he's basically got in a tussle. And that's continued for a passage of play. And then he's just sort of got swept off his feet and he's landed. And obviously through that act, he's damaged his hamstring. I'm not sure that's anything other than just an unfortunate collision in a game of high-level FA Cup football. So, yeah, it's maybe in keeping with the sense of kind of what have Norwich done this season, really, to and obviously the upside, of course, and we will get into this, I know, in due course, is they get back a player in Josh Sharden today, who himself has been out for 14 league games. So it's just the swings and roundabouts, really. But for it to be Nunes, I think, is the painful element because of what it means potentially for the Championship games ahead. Because as was graphically illustrated, when he was out, really anybody who came in was a pale imitation of him. And it's such an important area, as we know, of how Torrett wants to play the game, how he wants to progress the ball through those deeper areas, build-up-wise. To be without Nunes is a blow, no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to look it up, but I don't think there's many games this season that Norwich have had McLean, Nunez, Saints, Sargent all available at the same time. It probably feels like probably single figures, but you'd have to go and check it. But even, to be honest, having those four midfield options, when we think of Slimani, McLean, Nunez and Marcondes, it feels very rare that they've had those four available. That's before you chuck on Liam Gibbs and Jakob Sorensen and Gabe Forsyth as well, who's obviously emerged as a first-team option. So, yeah, we'll be crossing our fingers for that scan in the next couple of days, and hopefully it's on the better end of the spectrum, whatever that looks like. Whether that's 2 weeks or 2 days, I don't know. But hamstrings are always very delicate and you can get different grades of them. So, yeah, hopefully it's good news, and it feels like they're overdue some good news in that department and probably generally. Adam, I guess the other real talking point of the game, look, we could talk around players. We could talk about Lewis Dobbin, who I thought was pretty bright in patches, and, you know, Emmanuel Forsen, who before he went off at halftime showed some good flashes on the back of obviously the heroics from last weekend. But I think it's difficult to sit here and watch that game today. And it's not just Norwich. You look at QPR, who went to Leicester and they've lost by a 4-goal margin. West Brom went to Bournemouth, they've lost by a 4-goal margin. Of course, there is an outlier. Plymouth beat Brentford today, but they did that by having 28% possession, I think 11 touches in the opposition box, essentially 10 men behind the ball, and defend and hope you get a little bit of a luck and the Premier League team has an off day. So it's a reality now. It feels like a reality, not just in this competition, but the League Cup as well. Basically, you draw a Premier League team and you're done, basically. And that's not a nice place, I don't think, for English football, for the FA Cup, for the League Cup to be.
No, I think, you know, you talk about the magic of the FA Cup. For me, it comes more in the earlier rounds when you get the non-league teams up against the League One, League Twos, and you do get the odd shock at that level. And obviously, that's a huge benefit for those clubs in terms of TV revenue, the opportunity to try and potentially progress to, like Tamworth have got, you know, a Tottenham that can change their club and the whole future of that club moving forwards in terms of, you know, the money they're going to make from that game and the TV coverage, etc., etc. But in terms of the actual game and results, yeah, it's very few and far between these days that you see, you know, even Championship clubs beating Premier League clubs. And let's face it, even if you get to a point where you get to round five, you probably know you're going to end up with a Liverpool or a Man City or an Arsenal, and you're probably going to get knocked out. And I could probably be fairly confident right now that unless they all, you know, draw each other at some point in the next few rounds, at the semi-finals will probably involve all of those teams, if not, you know, certainly one or two of them. So yes, it doesn't quite have that same feeling about it, and probably for most of our certainly us two in terms of our lifetime, it's never really had kind of those outliers that have gone on to win it, you know, where you go sort of back in the day and teams generally would feel they have an opportunity to do that irrespective of their level. So in that sense, yeah, I think today I've certainly was heading to the ground with fairly, you know, a reasonable amount of confidence in Norwich are probably going to go out today. And unfortunately, I wasn't really that sad about it. You know, it's kind of one of those where you think, okay, well, if we get through this tie, then probably going to have another difficult test in the next one. And unfortunately, you know, as was proven today, the gap is just massive between the Championship and the Premier League. I know Brighton rested a few today, but you could still see the quality. They just had that extra little bit in different moments. Torrett was pretty good on it that Norwich, you know, had to take two free passes to get to a certain point where Brighton one pass, I mean, that was demonstrated, I think, was it the second goal, it just took three Norwich players out of the game within one movement. So yeah, that those are the levels, and you see it in the Premier League now anyway. I mean, Southampton haven't really invested heavily relative to the other couple of sides, or Leicester haven't done massively, but there's a very high probability that those three sides that got promoted last season are going to come straight back down. And unfortunately, that is the state of English football at the moment at the top.
Yeah, and even when you think of, let's say, Coventry, Pad, for sort of reasons, obviously they reached the semi-final last year. It was an epic run, but I don't think they played a Premier League team until the quarterfinals when they had Wolves. And obviously then progressed to get Manchester United, who, you know, if it wasn't for VAR, they would have beat. But it does feel increasingly like there's Norwich are, what, 11th in the Championship, Brighton are 10th in the Premier League. You can do the maths in terms of how many places that is, because I don't want to get it wrong. But it's not that many places, really, in terms of the pyramid. I mean, even Plymouth and Brentford, really, that's where the FA Cup is at the moment. We're talking about this being a massive shock, a Championship team beating a mid to lower end Premier League team. I mean, it as Adam says, illustrates the big gap that we see now between where Norwich City are, mid-table in the Championship, to where Brighton are, which is banging mid-table in the Premier League.
Exactly, and that's what they are. Okay, you know, they've had periods. De Zerbi had them up and around that, a little bit higher than that, and sort of competing and getting into Europe, didn't he? But they are a mid-table Premier League club, and that's not a slight. That's just an achievement.
7 years' work. That's what it's taken.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So by no manner of means have Norwich played the cream of the Premier League today, and the gulf was evident. I mean, the final 20 minutes, it could have been anything, really. It was just target practice. And to follow on from what you boys have just said there, yeah, I mean, this competition now, its reputation now is forged very much in a bygone era. You know, I was trying to think there, when was the last time there was a non Premier League club even got into the, well, it was Cov, wasn't it? But prior to Cov, or even the final, I think Millwall got there 1 year, didn't they, when Man United beat them, when they were a Championship club, Football League club. But, you know, my team won it in the 80s, and okay, they were in the top flight, as was then, but that was a huge shock. I mean, Wimbledon beating Liverpool.
Well, Sunderland beat Norwich, didn't they, in the semi-finals in 92, I think, and they were lower than Norwich at that stage to play Liverpool. So it did happen in a
well,
in a
I mean, not, and not even the final. I mean, obviously, again, my reference point is Coventry, and I think it was 2 years after they'd won it, they were knocked out by non-league Sutton, yeah. Which, I mean, that's, and they were still in the top tier of English football. It's just the landscape has completely shifted. Obviously, that was a pre-Premier League era. The revenue was completely chalk and cheese. And that, unfortunately, is what has completely neutralised this competition in terms of shocks that are, I cannot believe where that result has come from. The David and Goliath sort of cliche. I mean, those are very, very few and far between now. As you progress through the rounds, take Adam's point, you know, earlier, you know, non-league teams lower down the pyramid knocking out professional lower level Football League teams. But is that shock? Not in the epic reverberating nature of how it was in yesteryear. So, you know, that's why this competition now has lost its allure. And you know, it's not the only reason. I mean, the scheduling of it all, I'm having games on a Thursday night now, is just off. It's just ridiculous. I don't know where that's gone at all, what that's about. But it is sadly a pale imitation of what it was for people of a certain generation, certainly. And as a result, I don't think many of those in a very, very good crowd of 24,000 there today, many of those Norwich fans will go away today too upset about being knocked out of the FA Cup. I think they might be upset when they get sadly, some news about Nunes. Mm. That'll be more upsetting to them. But in terms of this competition, while it was a great ride for Cov last season, I think that is very much the anomaly now. And as Adam rightly said, more often than not, the closing stage of this competition, it's just a shootout between the haves rather than the have-nots.
Yeah, which is increasingly English football in a pyramid. We're talking and the pyramid itself, and every competition, it feels like it's six to maybe eight teams to win stuff, and then, you know, screw everyone else is essentially how it feels. And that's tough for Norwich, isn't it? Because there's so much made, and teams put up so much effort, and Norwich have done it in the past to build and build and build to try and get in the Premier League. And as you mentioned, you look at what it is at the moment. The three teams that went up last season came straight back down. that at the moment is, you know, those teams who went up from the Championship last year are in the relegation spots as things stand. We're in real danger here of a game, aren't we, of eliminating competition and getting to a stage where if you're a Norwich, if you're a Middlesbrough, a West Brom, teams like that who have aspirations to try and not just get into the Premier League but break into that top 17, it's beginning to feel near on impossible, really, unless you do maybe what Forest did a couple of years ago and break financial rules to do it.
That is seemingly at the moment the only way. I mean, I know there's a few anomalies. Obviously, Brentford didn't go too heavy, but then for me, even the landscape of the Premier League in the last 4 or 5 years has shifted dramatically, which kind of almost, I suppose, makes that feeling for Norwich fans all the more frustrating that, you know, that season that they won the league at a canter, they were quite clear actually of Brentford at that stage, and the way that the two clubs and their planets have sort of aligned differently ever since is quite stark, and yeah, it's tough and it's not enjoyable. I think, you know, you ask any Southampton fan right now whether they'd rather go back to that Wembley win and stay in the Championship or whether they want to endure what they're enduring at the moment. I'm pretty certain most of them would resign back to Championship football next season, because it's almost punishment, really, going to support your team and following them home and away, spending big money, just knowing that you're not going to be competitive, you've not got a chance, and almost if you score a goal, that's an achievement. So it's not a fun place to be, and something seriously has got to be done about it, really, if they want to make football competitive again. And it's so, well, it's all greed at the top. Obviously, we had all the Super League stuff, and I wouldn't be surprised if that resurfaces.
We're essentially there now, aren't we, yeah, really, we are. By stealth. If we get to a position again where those teams come down, then we've got a top 17, really.
Yep, and obviously then you've almost got the difference in the gap, I suppose, even at the top. I know Forest are a little bit of an anomaly at the moment, but then they've spent massive money anyway. So, you know, that's what it takes to be competitive. But, you know, it is ultimately the Premier League now is, aside from Leicester, the same 4 or 5 teams have won it every single season. You know, Man City had a run there of, what, 5, 6 years where they won it every single season. And I don't see how, you know, that's a fun place to be or a fun watch, where, you know, you contrast that to the Championship. You know, there's different, obviously has to be a different winner of it every single season due to the promotion element. But even just the shake-up in terms of, you know, where teams can be in the league, it's so different. You know, you can look at like a Luton who have come straight back down and suddenly they're struggling in the Championship. So how the Premier League can try and almost replicate that, what the Championship's got, I don't know, it's near on impossible, because the teams at the top are so greedy, and they'll continue to be like that.
Yeah, and it feels like it's gone, to be honest. I don't really know how you fix that. And like you say, I think because there's long been a debate in Norwich circles about, you know, people saying, oh, well, I prefer it in the Championship anyway. And often I think that gets misconstrued as an unambition. I don't think that's the reality at all. It's the picture that you painted. It's the reality of what the Premier League is when you go up as a newly promoted team, where you go up and you lose, if you're lucky, 20 games, and you know it's very difficult and it's very tough, and the only reward really is the financial aspect. There's no footballing enjoyment or entertainment for enjoyment. You know, how often have we seen a game like what we had last week with Forsen and the moments like that? So I think that's probably what we're more talking about, experience as a fan. And of course, Pei, there's another side to this as well, which is, for as big as that gap has got, clearly it gets pushed from both sides. So it also, I guess, encapsulates, as Adam said, Norwich were with Brentford, they're leading Brentford, they won the league ahead of Brentford a few years ago. It's also, you know, where Norwich have got to with bad decisions and bad appointments and bad recruitment, and over a consistent period, it you know, makes that gap even bigger whilst it's being pulled from the top end anyway.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, and to be fair, previous sporting director used to say, you know, you have to, if you're Norwich, particularly in the narrower prism of like recruitment, which is obviously where a lot of the focus was in that era, you pretty much have to get every decision right. Certainly the bigger outlays, you have to get them right. And that's not really realistic, is it? I mean, even the top clubs fail with their recruitment occasionally. There's so many variables, so many factors in play. It's not just, as we've sort of learned a little bit now this season with this intake, you know, with Forsen and what Johannes was saying recently after his commentary about, you know, the intangible, Cernach to a degree as well. Young men coming over, maybe not with their families, all the elements about off the pitch, which, you know, you need to feel settled, you need to feel comfortable in your environment off the pitch to be actually perform at your best on the pitch. It stands to reason. And as a result, you know, that is why, you know, particularly if you don't have the resource to kind of ride a number of poor decisions in terms of recruitment, which Norwich haven't had that luxury. You know, if they've got it wrong in windows, they've paid for those sins. Farke used to come out with that term when he inherited was paying for the sins of the past. And, you know, conversely, that golden age, if you want, of Weber and Farke, sort of 18, 19, was everything pretty much went right. You know, their recruitment went right. Pukki, Buendia, et al. The faith in youth, young players who not only were given a chance, but grabbed it. You know, Max Aaron's primarily amongst that. So that shows you what basically has to happen for a club of Norwich's infrastructure and financial resources as it was then. Slightly different now, obviously, we know the boardroom shift and the resources available. But still, even now, we know they're still on that self-sustainable path and trying to do it in a more holistic way and just make smart decisions, data-informed decisions at all areas of the business. But really, pretty much everything has to go right in every facet of the football operation for a Norwich to do what they did, which was break that ceiling, get the better of clubs that season in the Championship who had parachute money, who maybe had been in the Premier League and hadn't used their finances to the best and optimised it to the best. And it was only because that all came together so brilliantly, so perfectly, the perfect storm, that they actually made it to the Premier League. But of course, then that proved, you know, even with all that behind them, that infrastructure that they'd built, it was nowhere near good enough. Because then the reality of this discussion shows you that that isn't enough, that you do need that financial muscle to be able to compete, as well as being smart in your decision-making and astute and creative, and as Norwich were at that period, ahead of the curve, which they were, certainly in that Championship season. And that's really where we're now with Torup and Napa. They're trying to get ahead of the curve, trying to find those margins that aren't based on how deep is Attanasio's pockets, but that they can maximise areas that maybe other Championship clubs particularly aren't maximising, which is the data element of it all. But, you know, there's no guarantees with that. It may come together. It may come together and only advance them to a certain point, which might not necessarily be Premier League again. So what happens then? So, you know, it feels exciting. It feels fresh, even though there's been some, you know, and today was another one, a sort of difficult episodes to sort of digest on the pitch. But overall, the direction of travel feels new, feels optimistic under this head coach particularly, and the way he messages and communicates and the faith in younger players who are not right in the here and now ready, but maybe at some point in the future with the right coaching environment around them and the right cultures. But all of that, even if it came together as brilliant as it did in 18-19, isn't of itself probably going to give Norwich a fighting chance of staying in the Premier League. It's going to take something else. It might take finance. You know, it might take lots of other factors as well to do what a Brentford and what a Brighton have done. But as Mr. Weber himself used to point out, you know, and like to point out, even Brighton, you know, today, Tony Bloom, how much has he invested of his personal fortune? As smart and astute as that club have been, and Brentford likewise, they've had some very wealthy ownership. So, of itself, trying to do things in a smart, streetwise way isn't going to be good enough, I don't think, to bridge the gap that now exists clearly in terms of the Football League, the top end of the Championship and the Premier League. And, you know, nobody really, I think, has the answers unless you are going to try and mimic the Brighton and the Brentford model, which, you know, to a degree is where Norwich seem to be pivoting. You know, they've got the financial wherewithal now with Attanasio and his backers, or his, you know, his group. But also they're trying to, again, embrace, as Brighton and Brentford have done so successfully and probably ahead of the curve, this use of data to inform every area of the business.
Indeed. And like you say, even doing that is no guarantee. I think it took Brentford 7 years to get out of the Championship and into the Premier League. It's taken Brighton 7 years to get from a stage where they had Chris Hughton basically playing the way that Chris Hughton does, as we know, to well, we know probably better than most people his brand of football and to keep in the league to then build. And they're only really at a stage now, 7 years in, where they're beginning to try and play open, expansive, dominant football. That is the journey that you have to go on. It does feel a little bit soul-destroying, doesn't it? And you know, I don't know about you, gents, but I've found the Premier League a little bit tougher to get into and to watch and to consume lots of. It feel, you know, with VAR and just the various elements to it, it feels, you know, if there's a choice now between a Premier League game or an EFL game, I find myself probably drifting more towards the EFL game. That probably does us nicely for part one. We will come back for part two. Still plenty to discuss, from Josh Sargent to obviously the Borja Sainz stuff and the latest on the transfer front as well. See you in a second. Welcome back to the Pinken.com Norwich City podcast, brought to you in association with First Bus. Of course, reflecting not so much now on the FA Cup exit to Brighton. I think we sort of parked that. We're going to move on to other elements. But Adam, first and foremost, one major positive today was, and this is probably where we will leave the game up to this point, but it is on a positive note, and it's always good to end on a positive note. The sight of Josh Sargent back in yellow and green, back on a football pitch for Norwich City.
I certainly knew when he had arrived, because you could hear it when he came out to warm up, the noise, the applause, the USA chants. Everything was sort of back to normal, it felt, when that moment happened. And it's a huge boost, because we all know how much of a catalyst, how key Josh Sargent is to this Norwich City team. You know, without him, they didn't score the same level of goals, or anywhere near the same level of goals, as what they did in the early part of the season. You know, they were up and away the top goal scorers in the Championship. Of course, Borja Sainz had a part in that, but those two's relationship was crucial, really, in some of those early games. You know, you go back to the win at Derby and how they had to come out and win that game. It was Josh Sargent providing Borja Sainz on that occasion, and it was kind of those two linking up on different moments in the early parts of the season that generated the results that I think had everyone dreaming that Norwich were almost ahead of the curve to where they were, or even are at now, where, you know, I still feel they're making pretty steady progress. It's big. Obviously, they need to manage it and be careful, because the last thing you want to be doing is putting him in a starting 11 too early and too quickly, because, you know, unfortunately, his history with injury has kind of plagued moments in his Norwich City career, and it is frustrating. I think it's kind of held him back from sort of becoming even better as a player. He's obviously still a young man, and the step and progress he's made to this point, obviously he's had to drop down from the Premier League to the Championship, but you know, his all-round game has definitely improved. And I certainly think under this manager, in the system and the way they play, I think he's well suited to it. He's the perfect fit, really, and he is probably the most complete striker in the Championship. So the fact you've had him miss him for, what, two-thirds of the campaign so far is definitely going to have a massive impact on Norwich's season. So we saw the impact last year when he came back in the second half of the season, and what that provided for Norwich and where it got them to, obviously, the platform to get into the playoffs. They certainly would not have been anywhere near that had he have not been available. So I'm not saying that's going to be the case this time round, because as we've kind of spoken around in part one, Nunez looks like he might be out for another period now, and he's kind of in Sargent's absence probably been the most key player, really, in the last couple of months. It's going to be difficult. They almost need all the stars to align, everyone to be available for that to happen. But just to have him back is huge, because you can feel it in the crowd. And kind of, I know you posted it to Torup yesterday, kind of the impact it would have on the group. And I think if you're a player in that camp, you can't not look at Josh Sargent and feel that we've got a better chance when we enter that football pitch for those 90 minutes, because he's a goal scorer at this level, and I think he will get back there pretty shortly.
Yeah, and it was telling today, even at 4-0 down, one of the first things he did on the pitch was to hold off a defender and muscle his way through to almost create an opportunity. And that was quite telling. That was considerably more than perhaps anyone ahead of him on the pitch had done in the period that he wasn't on it. So, yeah, a little bit more of that. And it was obviously interesting to hear Torup say that he felt that Sargent was in a position where he could start probably one of the next two games. Which I've got a feeling might be Sheffield United. But we've won back in, Paddy. It's another one out, such as this season, where it feels like there's been so many different threads to unfurl, and then eventually you get the hang of one and another one goes. And yeah, it's just felt a little bit like that. Borja Sainz obviously served the first of a six-game ban, so five games to go now for the spitting incident at Sunderland. Now we know it's kind of all done and processed, and what he's looking at in terms of suspension, £12,000 fine as well. I think we can talk about it in a lot more detail. I think there have been various elements with FA processes and FA decisions, the Kenny McLean one at QPR that I think we all probably disagreed with in terms of it meeting the threshold to be retrospectively banned. This is one where the player, the club, can have absolutely no complaints about.
No, it's a disgusting act, and it's an embarrassment, really, that Norwich, as a club, have got to deal with this, unfortunately. And it's on the player, you know. I will say, and it's not meant to be any mitigation whatsoever, because, he himself was quite early in this process accepted that, he had committed that offence. And the statement that came out from the club attributed to Borja after the verdict on Friday was very reflective, and not trying to hide from his actions, and that they're completely unacceptable. He let a lot of people down inside and outside the club. So all of that is the case. But actually, going back to the Sunderland game, the player involved, Chris Mepp, it was very clear to me watching that game at the Stadium of Light that his mission, as a lot of Championship defenders have been in this period, it was to stop Borja Sainz by fair means or foul. It was a campaign, basically, all through the game. I was actually a bit surprised when the FA charge came out and it related it to an incident in the 74th minute of the game, because I thought it might have been in the first half where Sainz had gone down the wing with Mepham, O'Nyan, I think, was playing right back that day. And they clearly, I think one of them put their arm out and he's gone down. And I think Mepham was more or less intimating that Sainz had, feigned injury there. And as the play switched swiftly to the other end of the pitch, there was two separate occasions where he's basically just gone out of his way to barge into Sainz. So, no, completely needless. There's no need for it at all.
Also the goal celebration.
Exactly.
After, I think, the second
one. Provocation was there. Now, as I say, none of that excuses a pretty deplorable act from Sainz. And I think this is where Torrup was hitting the right note yesterday, where he said that effectively this is now his status in the Championship, particularly off the back of what he has done. That his card is now marked. Championship teams, Championship defenders will do whatever it takes to wind up a player who has, and we've seen it before. I know they got the Middlesbrough red overturned with Johnny Howson, but he reacted that day. He reacted to a stiff challenge from Johnny Howson. It was a petulant kick out. Yes, I know it was rescinded, but that's in him. That's part of his character.
West Brom as well.
West Brom with the imaginary card. So he's a young man. I don't really want to go down the route. It's the Latin temperament, and they're a bit fiery and hair trigger, because I don't think that washes really. I think it's more the immaturity of him and having to come to terms with defenders now who will do whatever it takes on or off the ball to try and halt him, because they know how dangerous he is and how fearsome he is at this level in terms of his shooting ability in and around the box. He has to deal with that, but he has to deal with it in a way that is punish them on the pitch, punish them through his actions on the pitch and what he can do on the ball. And in this period, culminating in this Sunderland episode, he hasn't really done that, has he? He's been, so far below the levels that he'd reached previously. And Yanis has talked about this. He's going to have to go away now. And maybe this six-game period, five games now, will allow him that reflection, that headspace to come back better as a person, better as a footballer. And then if that is the case, and he picks up where he left off at the start of the season and has a real strong end to the season, then some good will have come of this latest episode. Because something needs to change in his makeup, and now he's handling himself on the pitch, because that isn't acceptable. And now, Torrup is purely on the footballing point, is without probably his, alongside Sargent, his most attacking weapon for quite a crucial period of the season. And the fact that, as we discussed after the game, one of the games potentially is Derby, but if Derby get through in the FA Cup tie that they had called off against Leyton Orient this weekend, then that game will be postponed, and this could push in now to mid-February, which is a hell of a block of time. It's almost like he's going to have a pre-season again, as well, from that aspect, from the fitness point of view, to be ready to go again. So as I say, I'm glad that the club have been pretty strong on it, because they should be, because it was, you know, completely unacceptable, and it doesn't do Norwich's image any good in the game, and that's not a great place to be. And you just hope, as I say, that he learns from it, and whatever the propagation moving forward, he cannot react like that. And let's hope, you know, as to be fair, he probably did learn from the West Brom incident. He did learn maybe from the Middlesbrough incident. You know, he has shown that capacity to grow, and he certainly has flourished in a footballing sense under Torup this season. But he also needs to grow, I think, as a person and mature a little bit and understand that he's now a marked man. And he won't be the first person who's had to deal with that. So maybe it's a case of, you know, going away and looking at players maybe who play in similar positions to him and how they've dealt with that rise up the ranks, as it were, and come back stronger and almost reinvented themselves a little bit. But, I mean, six games for me is you can't argue with it, really. You know, it is reflective of the incident and his part in it. And I don't think anybody wants to see that, really. And that's why, you know, let's hope this is the last kind of episode where we're talking about Borja Sainz's temperament and his character, rather than what we should be talking about with him, which is his footballing ability.
Yeah, and if he wants to play at the top level as well, that's a major turn off for clubs, because you've got to be available. And if you're going to have that sort of edge to your game and the disciplinary issues, and he's got a few now against him, as you mapped out, it's going to be difficult, and it's a mark against his name almost, isn't it? And it's a shame, given what he's done this season, the goals that he's scored. I don't think he's performed great, if I'm honest, all season long. But he's been excellent at scoring goals and scoring excellent goals and important goals and match-winning goals. And if you do that, you are going to have defenders trying to stop you, particularly when they know your history and the way that you react. And it's not good. It's not a good look for Norwich. It's not a good look for him. And of course, it points to, you know, maybe wider question marks, Adam, of their discipline, because, you know, they had the club captain Kenny McLean banned for an extra game for some horrendous language that he used towards a match official, which you just can't do. And that's a player on the other end of the spectrum. Cordoba, obviously, with a needless red card. I think they've basically, between them, McLean, Cordoba and someone else, have missed about 14 games this season as a result of discipline. QPR, whether you can, you know, I don't think it was the right decision, but it's another one that will be put on the table and levelled against them. It does feel like there isn't an ill discipline to this squad at the moment.
It does, and unfortunately, if they do want to try and at some point progress themselves to be a club that want to try and be in and around the top six, try and push for promotion to the Premier League, they can't afford to be missing that many players through suspension over the course of a season, and certainly not key players. You know, we all know how key Kenny is to this group. The results without him speak for themselves. You know, he is the leader, almost that glue in the central midfield that they require, and their results are poorer without him. And, you know, for a captain, as he has been on the pitch so for much of this season, obviously in Grant Hanley's absence, it's not a great look when, you know, he's been missing for, what, a little bit less now than probably a third. But obviously, you know, at that point, certainly when he came back from suspension, about a third of the season, you know, that's poor. And you can obviously debate the QPR one. I mean, I still think it was wrong, but you've still given the option there by you know, I suppose the FA are probably tighter on Norwich because of the amount of discipline charges against them already so far this season. And, you know, you can, Angus Gunn obviously had a little bit of a lucky escape to not get any game bans, any suspensions off the back of kicking the substitutes board. And, you know, I know this raw emotion, football's all about emotion, and you don't want to be taking that out of the game, but it's about channeling it in the right way and not letting moments like Mepham getting in your face getting the better of you. You almost just need to let your football do the talking. Don't kind of rush into things or make these poor mistakes, because ultimately you're not just costing yourself, you're costing Norwich as a unit, as a team. And it just requires someone internally with a bit of leadership to almost sit this group down and try and stamp it out, because there's clearly a problem at the moment. Obviously, a lot of them are still young men. Some of them are new into the league, and it might take time for certain individuals. I know Cordoba will be frustrated probably at the manner of his red card, but obviously that was an on-the-field challenge rather than, you know, things off the pitch or incidents that don't relate directly to the game. So, yeah, someone's got to get a grip on it, whoever it might be, to sort of, yes, to stamp it out, because next season it will cost them if they want to try and eventually push on higher up the league.
All I would say on this is, you know, as we've discussed here, I think Borja Sainz can have no complaints. Six games, I think, for spitting at an opponent is the right sanction. It feels correct. It feels probably tough enough in terms of trying to stamp it out. It's also been basically what we've seen in the past. I think Perry NG at Cardiff when he was previously at Crewe had one and was given six games. Hayden Hackney as well when he was on loan at Scunthorpe. So there are previous examples, and I think it's right that it has that tariff. What I would say is, to be in a position where if he'd have gone up to Mepham and slapped him, he'd have got three games. I'm not quite sure that's right in terms of a measure. So it probably feels like we need to see more of those offences dragged up in terms of games that players get, so they're in line with an offence like spitting, rather than perhaps seen as lower grade. To be in a position, for example, where Cunha gets two games for what he did against Ipswich, and the FA said, "Oh, we'll knock a game off because you paid for the glasses." I think that's, you know, that's Mickey Mouse stuff, isn't it, really? So, you know, we should be talking about those physical offences in the same way that we talk about spitting, because all of them are unacceptable, and all of them, you know, there shouldn't be a grade as to how bad an offence is. It should be, well, if you've physically struck someone or hurt someone in a deliberate manner, then that clearly should have a bigger sanction than just three games and come under violent conduct for me. So, yeah, there we go. That's a general issue, but yeah, it's up to now Borja Sainz to prove that he can learn from this and provide a response, because if it happens again, I think it's going to be very difficult for him to. Yeah, I don't know. I think it probably brings the discussion to a different place. So let's hope that's not the case. Let's move on then, Paddy, to where Norwich City are in terms of transfers. We already discussed probably the midfield element that feels like it's going to come back into play. Mateo Juricic, as we record, that feels like it's edging closer. As we record, because these things can and do change very quickly, and we know that there's been a breakthrough between the clubs now, and in terms of club to club agreement and €7 million agreement, which I think is about 5.8 million, isn't it? But that includes add-ons and bonuses and stuff, so that isn't the flat fee that's on the table. Anas Ben Slimani, obviously his permanent move from Sheffield United, edging closer as well. And it feels like from an incoming perspective, there is now progress being made.
Yes, that would seem to be the case, Connor. I think Slimani will be very swiftly into the new week, that's confirmed. And Juricic put it to Giannis after the game this evening. Clearly, he's not going to stand up that because I think there's a few obstacles to clear yet. You know, chiefly among them probably getting the player over and getting some signatures on contracts and what have you. But medicals, yeah. And the reason I mention those elements, even though it feels like they're almost procedural at this stage when there's an agreement in place, is because Giannis's answer was essentially along the lines of, look, do we want to do something in that area of the squad? Yes. Will we do it? Yes. Things are ongoing, but there were deals in the summer that they got very long way down the road, thought they'd got them over the line, and then they didn't happen. He didn't mention any, but clearly the Turkish forward, Yildirim, would fit into that category, which was a deal that fell down, you know, over medical concerns. I think we'll put it in those terms. So until everything is signed and sealed, then Matej Juricic will remain a Slavia player. But I think the expectation is now, in the last 24, 48 hours, that there is an outline of an agreement between the clubs. That was the only real element of this that had to be resolved. And seems like they're all comfortable with the figures. The player wants to come to England. I don't think the finances around the players wages of this will present any problem whatsoever, given the dialogue that's been ongoing. So, yeah, it feels like it's heading into a positive space, with that caveat, of course, you know, until things are signed, sealed and delivered, and he's at Colney holding up a yellow and green shirt or a scarf, or doing them signing videos that we all love, and then we won't say it's 100% done at this stage, but it would seem now it would take a very unforeseen turn of events for him not to be, you know, Norwich's headline January signing. And after the discussion we've just had on Sainz, I know they don't play like for like in terms of the area of the pitch, wide area, but he is another body, and they certainly need another one in that either side of Sargent, part of this 11 now. And you know, the sooner he comes in the building, given his pedigree, we know he's not played a huge amount of football this season. But if you're coming from a team of the most dominant team in the Czech league and playing regularly in Europe, he's a full international. He was in the country's Euro 2024 squad. he actually played as well, I think, in some of those games in the summer. You know, that's a pedigree of player. I think Norwich in the Championship, you've got to feel can come in and, like Cernach, probably mould him, Schwartau, maybe even Forsen now after what we've seen against Coventry, mould them into real better than Championship grade players, because that's ultimately what Norwich are trying to do, assemble a squad of young talents primarily who are better than the Championship and can take this club back to the Premier League.
Yes, and if he does get over the line, I think, and shout at me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure this is the case, it'll be Norwich's first permanent January edition since whoever came second of Onel Hernandez or Dennis Rebeni. And I've got in my head, I think it was Dennis Rebeni who came post Onel Hernandez, but I think they were very, very close in terms of the period that they joined. So that was 2018.
Philip Heisel, not a permanent.
Philip Heisel, he was. What year was that? Was that 2018 as well?
Was he not? I think he was a bit later, mate, yeah.
Was he? Was he not the 18-19 season?
Well, he might have been, yeah. I don't know where he was at. I'm trying to think.
Can we really count? Well, he was permanent, so I guess we can. Yeah, maybe it is the first since Heisler. Was but that the Premier League
Onel,
campaign?
Onel was 2017-18 January window, not 18-19.
Of course, yeah.
So definitely not him.
So it would have been Heisler then in that year. So I've got the window right, but the player wrong. So if it was Heisler.
I think so. So Benny, he was also that same window, wasn't he? So yeah, Heisler would be post both of those two.
Wow. if there's anyone from the club watching, and I'm sure there will be, if they don't use some sort of Jurassic Park, Eurosec Park announcement video, I think we'd all be very disappointed. You've been to Prague. How's he going to find Norfolk, do you think, if it does get over the line?
Yeah, I've actually seen him play, which is something I didn't realise till about a week or so back. When was it? A couple of years back now. I went to Prague in the summer and actually took in a Slavia Prague game, a league game over there. They won 6-0. Jurasek got an assist that night. I've got no recollection of that assist. I've not gone back and watched it to see it. But Prague is a busy city, but it's not kind of your London levels of busy. By all accounts, I think he's quite a one for the city, to be fair. So I imagine he'll enjoy taking in some of the sights. Maybe Borja can take him round and show him those, because I think they might be on a similar page on that one. So
and of course, if he wants to get around, he can use First Bus. So well, he's got a brilliant bus service to use.
He can. We highly recommend First Bus. So Matej, if you're struggling for cars or taxis in Norwich, then yeah, I think the people at First Bus can sort you out. But yeah, I think it might actually be a benefit to him coming to Norwich, a little bit more of a quiet place, get his head down, let the football do the talking. And that's kind of what some of these players have done when they've moved here. And, you know, you hear it in the media. Some of these players, when they move on, they talk about Norwich being quite a quiet place. But sometimes that can be a benefit. And he's got to try and embrace that and harness that. Because if he does, you know, then hopefully he can help Norwich on the pitch.
Yeah, and very quickly, Paddy, in terms of Slimani, obviously Norwich had an option to do this in the summer. They didn't have to do it now. They didn't have to get the ball rolling on this one. Sort of asked Johannes about it on Friday, and he spoke about the clarity for the player. And I would imagine there's probably some financial elements as well in terms of accounting and profit and sustainability rule, maybe considerations as well, but probably not primarily. Can you understand why they've done that now on the evidence of what we've seen so far?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely. I think the trigger is probably that Sheffield United have made it clear that, you know, Chris Wilder has, that he's the same thing, that he's not got any future there. So, you know, why do something in the summer that all parties could happily shake hands and have done and on in this window? Obviously, the fact that he's not playing at the moment is a slight frustration. But I think we'd seen enough in the games previously, and I've said it a few times now, you know, at 23, hopefully those fitness-related, not that this particular one, this is ankle ligaments, I don't think you can hang this on to go back to the right to the start of the podcast, and we're talking about, you know, fitness-related issues. But he clearly arrived with, Johannes talked openly about it, a sort of sense that his body needs to be a bit more robust, a bit more championship-hardened, and that'll probably now, In a similar vein, the fact that he becomes a Norwich player, I think you wrote a piece, and it's like that he's now Norwich's player. It's not feeding back data and being guided by what Sheffield United want, because he's Sheffield United's player. Now Norwich can really map out not just the rest of this season, but maybe into the summer, you know, because he's their asset effectively. And the figures themselves, well, it is a no-brainer for a 23-year-old who's had a good career so far in Denmark and full international for Tunisia as well. So, yeah, there's a lot to like about this deal, I think. So for me, it's not a surprise, really. I think if Sheffield United had been of the opinion that they wanted to wait and see, then clearly the deal doesn't get done. But from the Norwich side, you go right back to when he came through the door. It was like he's desperate to work with Johannes. Johannes knew him from a very young age and felt he could fit the template. So from the Norwich side of this equation, there was already a very real understanding on both sides that they were looking at it as longer term. So if that's the case, the only other factor or the only other actor in play here was Sheffield United. And if they've now indicated that, yep, we're quite happy to bring that forward, then makes a lot of sense, I think, yeah.
Agreed. To end the pod then, Adam, two away trips coming up for Norwich City. The first next week, and we'll all make sure we're bang on time at Bramall Lane for Sheffield United game. And then the small matter of Leeds and Elland Road in midweek. Doesn't get much tougher than that, does it, by Championship standards?
No, that's going to be a real test, and that test got even bigger if the news on Nunez is as bad as I think we all probably expect it's going to be, because, you know, he's been pivotal. You know, you go back to that Luton game where they were sort of under the cosh at different points. His quality that moment wins them the game, and it kind of feels like if Norwich are going to navigate the next two games, it's probably going to have to be back to the walls a little bit again. Maybe not play that Hofball brand of football particularly. They're going to have to do it in a slightly different way. Be dogged, don't give up chances, and then when you get the opportunity, you've got to take it. And obviously they were at Borja as well now, as we've mentioned, so it's going to be difficult. But, you know, I think as they've sort of proven over the festive period as a block, and even going to Sunderland, they were competitive really up until kind of, you know, the red card that ultimately cost them really in the end. They just now need to try and obviously do that, as they showed at Sunderland that day. They've done it for 45 minutes, they need to do it for 90 minutes. So I think they've gradually started to show they're starting to do that more consistently. So if they can take that to those sort of places and try and get those crowds almost against, not against their team, but, you know, turn them slightly away from their side, if they can frustrate them, then who knows, there might be something there for them.
6 points on the table. How many are they going to get?
Let's go for three. Let's say they win one.
Ooh, nice. Paddy, same question.
Zero. This is filtered, yeah, through no Nunez. Yeah. My mind goes back, talking about Luton. Last season at Leeds, Nunez and McLean were excellent for a spell. I know they lost 1-0 on the night, but I'm not referring to the playoff game, by the way. I'm talking about the league game. He was brilliant that night, Nunez. So take him out of the equation. I don't see a lot of hope from these two away games.
That's not a nice cheery note to end on, is it?
One thing that we've forgotten to add. Obviously, we did hit 10,000 subscribers.
Oh, yes, we did.
Go back on. It must have been the start of December now.
Thank you, Wayne Rooney.
Yes, he's definitely helped us on that cause. Then we said we were going to do a giveaway, and we kind of, I don't know, just the busy December schedule and various other events off the pitch just meant that it kind of got pushed further and further down the line. I think we're now actually put on another 300 subscribers since then. So thank you for everyone who's joined the journey. If you're not already, hit that button down below and hit that subscribe button. But yeah, we have got a little giveaway that we're going to do, a £75 Norwich City gift card for the club shop. So that should be enough to cover a shirt for this season, and maybe something else. So I think we've got a question, which I'll leave you to ask, Connor.
Yes, so our question, and sadly, we thought of this pre-game, so it is going to be FA Cup related. We want to know, and how are they going to submit their answers? Can they sort of comment below? How are we going to do it?
Yeah, you can comment down below, or if not, yeah, on any of our social feeds under the sort of, you know, we'll obviously promote this podcast down below and in there, or you can DM us, email us.
Just get it to us, and you'll be registered. But essentially the question is going to be: Norwich City, obviously in last year's FA Cup, were beaten 5-2. It was 5-2, wasn't it? 5-2 against Liverpool. We want you to tell us the two Norwich City scorers from that game, and if you do that, then you'll enter the competition.
Can I enter?
Can Paddy enter?
No, probably not.
Probably not. No.
Employees are not.
Probably
allowed.
Not. No. All family members, I think. Okay, we're probably going to have to extend it to that as well. So, that is the question. So get in touch with that. Leave it down below. Make sure you've subscribed and liked and all of that good stuff. And, you'll be registered. When are we announcing the winner, Adam? That's something we haven't talked about.
Or maybe by the end of the... Well, let's go for the next podcast, because that's okay. A week, isn't it?
So. Yeah. there you go. You've got a week, so get them in quickly. And obviously, we've left this till last, so they'll have to watch or listened all the way through to get to this point anyway to do it. So there we go. That's a nice place to leave it. No Wembley FA Cup trip for Norwich City. I left off the playoffs there deliberately because we don't quite know how that's going to pan out. But definitely no FA Cup Wembley run for Norwich City this season. Back to league action next week with a trip to Sheffield United. We will be back with the next podcast after that. See you soon.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.